This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Mad Men, the AMC drama series set in a 1960 Madison Avenue advertising firm, has just been nominated for 16 Emmy Awards, including Best Drama Series, as well as Best Art Direction, Costumes, and Hairstyles. Mad Men takes us back to a time and place where men in suits and brill-creamed hair ruled the workplace, fueling their long hours with martinis, cigarettes, and Alka-Seltzer. They made their living figuring out what made Americans buy stuff. In this scene, ad man Don Draper, played by John Hamm, is talking to a waiter, played by Mark McGann, about why the waiter smokes Old Golds instead of the brand of Draper's client, Lucky Strikes.
But what is it? I mean, low tar, those new filters? Why Old Gold?
They gave them to us in the service, a carton a week for free.
So you're used to them, is that it?
Yeah, they're a habit.
Well, I could never get you to try another brand, say, my Lucky's.
I love my Old Golds.
All right, well, let's just say tomorrow a tobacco weevil comes and eats every last Old Gold on the planet.
That's a sad story.
It's a tragedy. Would you just stop smoking?
I think I could find something. I love smoking.
I love smoking. That's very good.
My wife hates it. Reader's Digest says it will kill you.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Ladies love their magazines.
Yes, they do.
A scene from the AMC series Mad Men. The first season is now out on DVD. Our guest is Matt Weiner, the series' creator, executive producer, and writer of several episodes. He spent 4 years on The Sopranos as a writer and executive producer. I spoke to Matt Weiner last August about creating Mad Men. Well, Matt Weiner, welcome to Fresh Air. Why was this a particularly interesting moment for American advertising?
Well, it's interesting for American advertising because it's sort of seen as the 1959 is actually the beginning of what's seen as the creative revolution. And it begins with Doyle Dane Birnbach's ad for Volkswagen, which is Think Small, which had a very – first of all, it was done by Jews and Italians, which was not the mainstream in advertising. Advertising was about selling you an idealized version of yourself, and suddenly there was this very subversive joke, basically, about advertising. It was graphically different. It spoke directly to the audience, and it said, we're trying to sell you something. Isn't that funny? Why don't you buy it? And that was a sort of the directness of that appealed to what I think is what's always there in American culture, which is a subversion, a sense of a problem with authority. And once that became part of the fabric of the culture and that ad was very successful, by 1961, 62, almost everyone was doing that. And what we see as advertising right now, these sort of joke ads that say I'm selling you something or something advertising has always been part of humor. When advertising itself becomes part of that and mostly fueled by a non-white, even though these people are white, but a non-white shoe advertising firm attitude about it, that really was the beginning of the creative revolution. And it took a long time for people to get on board with it.
You mentioned something about white shoe advertising firms. What are they? What did you mean by that term?
White shoe advertising firms. I mean, it's the establishment of advertising, which is the big agencies and the sort of what we usually see the 50s represented by is this advertising that's now seen as very kitsch, which is a woman in the kitchen trying to get the latest technology, the man coming home with the hat on. The Leave It to Beaver sort of image was promoted by a certain kind of advertising agency, which were the ones that were the most successful. And then along came something that said, guess what? We know your life isn't like that. We know you're not Ozzie and Harriet. Here's a car for you. Here's Avis, we try harder. You don't have to be, we're number two. You don't have to be Jewish to eat Levy's rye bread. All of these ads were done with a sense of humor that says, we know you're not Ozzie and Harriet. But the image of Ozzie and Harriet was promoted by establishment, corporate, gigantic ad agencies.
And Sterling Cooper, the ad agency that's the center of this series, is that a white shoe firm?
It is a white shoe firm. It's a third-tier firm, and I think as the show progresses, people will realize that they, I mean, dramatically, it's more interesting. They're pretty much on the wrong side of everything. You know, one of the things I'm interested in is this white male dominance of the marketplace and this kind of white tiger that's disappearing, and they're either going to have to get on board or not get on board.
And did you find ad men from this era to talk to and reminisce about?
I have since I wrote it. I wrote the script 7 years ago, and I really had a hard time finding any human beings who had been there who wanted to talk to me, mostly because a lot of them were dead. These are very hard living people, and that was what was so appealing about it. Now, since then, I've run into people, although most of them started in 62, 63, 64. What I have found is a lot of women, because I think there was a huge influx of women coming to New York in the late 60s to be secretaries and to find their way. And I've contacted a lot of those people have contacted me, and I've got the reports I've gotten about what's there have been amazing.
Let's listen to a cut from the first episode.
Sure.
And this is one where there's sort of two parts to it. And at the end of it, I'm just going to explain it. I mean, what we hear is
sure.
The central character of the series, whose name is Don Draper, played by John Hamm. And he's sort of lecturing one of the junior members of the firm, Pete Campbell, who's played by Vincent Kartheiser. And one of the things he's lecturing him about is the way this character, Pete Campbell, had just spoken to a new secretary who's played by Elizabeth Moss. So it begins with this character, Pete Campbell, sizing up a new secretary. Let's listen.
Where are you from, honey?
Miss Deaver's secretarial school.
Top notch. But I meant, where are you from? Are you Amish or something?
No, I'm from Brooklyn.
Well, you're in the city now. Wouldn't be a sin for us to see your legs. If you pull your waist in a little bit, you might look like a woman.
Is that all, Mr. Draper?
Hey, I'm not done here. I'm working my way up.
That'll be all. Peggy, right?
Yes. Oh, and it's time for your 11 o'clock meeting.
Oh, and sorry about Mr. Campbell here. He left his manners back at the fraternity house.
She's a little young for you, Draper.
Future Mrs. Pete Campbell's a very lucky woman. When's the wedding again?
Sunday. Did Ken tell you about the bachelor party tonight?
He sure did.
So do I get first crack at her? Word is she took down more sailors than the Arizona.
How old are you, Pete?
I just turned 26.
I bet the whole world looks like one great big brassiere strap just waiting to be snapped. Hmm?
You are good with words, Draper.
Campbell, we're both men here, so I'm gonna be direct.
Christ, are you already sleeping with her?
Advertising is a very small world, and when you do something like malign the reputation of a girl from the Steno pool on her first day, you make it even smaller. Keep it up, and even if you do get my job, you'll never run this place. You'll die in that corner office, a mid-level executive with a little bit of hair who women go home with out of pity. Want to know why? Because no one will like you.
And that's from the AMC series Mad Men. It's created by my guest, Matt Weiner. But I just love that scene. There's so much going on there. one of the things going on there, of course, is this raw ambition. Everybody wants everybody else's office. But it's that lecherous sexism in the office that really jumps out at you. I mean, the kind of things that you would really never hear these days. And when you write scenes like this, you've got to take your own post-Anita Hill consciousness and make this dialogue believable. How do you do it, and how do you know you're not taking it too far?
I think that the conversation is derived from the same kind of conversation we have now. You know, there's men do speak this way to each other. They may not be as succinct and witty as these people are, but what I love is what Don is saying to him is this is an office. And you are behaving badly for your goals of achieving success at this office. And you're talking about a woman's reputation. And they're all very, very sort of moral stances as defined by that period. A woman's reputation, your reputation here. What is the death of a salesman? He was liked but not well liked. These are all the standards of how to behave in a business environment. And at the same time, Don is saying, like, you know, you're never going to have sex in the future because you're being inappropriate. He's not saying anything about what he thinks of women or how women are to be treated or how they're to be treated in his personal life. And what I really try and do is just think about – I try to be honest. And have people speak to each other in a frank manner. There's so much lying that goes on in this environment, and I love the concept of the audience knowing something about a character that the other character in the scene doesn't know, and that's just a dramatic construct. Pete has a line, this anti-Semitic slur that he says that's, you know, very glancing, but if you're Jewish, very specific. He says, adding money and education doesn't take the rude edge out of people. And that's something I overheard in my life. You know, that's not old. So what I try and do is have people say things in as frank a manner as possible, and the attitudes being that men somehow, white men, view themselves as us. I think every group views themselves as us and everyone else is them. And there's a security in that. And everything, every comment on every other group, every denigration is really delivered as a kind of with a kind of kindness, with a kind of pity for the fact that that group does not understand what we are up to.
Did ad executives really have, you know, bottles of bourbon on the credenza and open them up at 3 p.m?
Well, this is not a myth. It depends on who you talk to, and it depends on the agency. I have had I can name names of people who have seen this and said that there is not enough drinking. There was a wonderful email that I got. Bob Levinson was at who's at ICM was at BBDO in 1960 on the Lucky Strike account, and I was terrified to talk to him after he saw the pilot. And he said, "Do you have a time machine? How old are you? Where did you get this?" And he gave it to someone he began working with, Brandon Stoddard, who eventually became in charge of ABC, I think. And the email said, "Look at that. Remember us, the secretaries, the drinking, the smoking." He says, "God, I wish we were that smart." So, and then there's another group of people who are so – it's funny. I think George Lois, you know, who is such an icon of advertising, and of course his impact was a couple of years after this, but he's been so brash about talking about how – saying a couple of things about the show. One of them was, why didn't anyone come to him to do the show? And the other one is that we change the world, and there's this sort of like brashness about it, and how shallow they look, and this hucksterism and this Hollywood image. And honestly, when I read his when I read his letter about the show, I thought, oh my God, you're confirming everything I thought about the personality of the person that does this.
Wow.
You know, I find that I've anecdotally heard people say, like Jerry Delafemina said to me, there's not enough drinking in it. And it obviously depended on who the person was. And when you hear the stories, they definitely had all their meetings in the morning. They definitely went and got drunk at lunch. And when I say they, it's not everybody, but it's a heck of a lot more people than do it now.
Let's talk about your visual approach to this series. I mean, it looks different. How do you create the visual look of this series?
Well, it was a conscious decision because I wanted to do the period, but I didn't want the audience to have any moment of abstraction. I didn't want to shoot it in black and white. I didn't want to glamorize it. I wanted it to feel like we were in that space and that the people would be real. And the first thing that happened was the ceiling, making sure that we saw that ceiling, because that ceiling exists in all of our workspaces right now. And I thought that was something that would
bring people in. You mean the ceiling in the offices?
The ceiling in the office itself.
Describe it.
It's a drop ceiling with fluorescent lights in a pattern. And there's more venting in it now. There might be some fire safety that there wasn't at that time. But what you see is the typical office park insurance company ceiling, which is a drop ceiling with acoustic tiles and checkerboarded with fluorescent lights. And obviously you don't see this a lot on TV because it's very hard to shoot, and because fluorescent lights they require a lot of color correction. But once the production designer and I had agreed that it was about the ceiling, and we had a director who was really into low angles, Alan Taylor, our commercial sensibilities sort of overlap at Hitchcock, and we both sort of said, let's take advantage of all this. Then it became a matter of creating the period in a realistic way. And that means that when you do 1960, someone did not go out to a store and buy everything that day. The women's clothing is not from Vogue magazine 1960, because it wasn't available to people, regular people, until 1962. Couture, you know, takes a couple of years to filter down the hairstyles and so forth. You can't just look at a bunch of magazines. So when you, if you were doing 2007, you can look around and see there are people dressed from the 80s. There are antiques around. There's furniture. There's this, everything that went on beforehand is existing at the same time. So Peggy is wearing a dress from the early 50s, and the hairstyles are different on different women. And then, of course, I felt that television and movies in particular, the glamour, besides having everything from the same period, is usually about a kind of cleanliness. And some of that comes from the fact that it's very expensive to put in the detail that you need. So I immediately said, okay, you look up a picture from a Herman Miller catalog of one of these offices. The desks still exist. They're available at Staples. We put these desks in. You never see any of the wires from the telephones and the typewriters and the lamps, because when you take a picture, you don't want to see that. Well, you see all that in this. You see the full ashtrays everywhere that we grew up with. You see sweat stains and wrinkles and hair out of place. You see clutter. You see personal items. You see bowls of candy. You see everything but gum stuck on the bottom of the shoe. And I told you I wrote this 7 years ago. And one of the things that AMC gave me complete creative freedom, but one of the things that I added to the script, other than that, I shot the script I wrote back then. One of the things I added was this moment in the pilot where Don looks up at the ceiling and sees this fly in the light fixture. And I know that some people see it as a symbolic thing that he's trapped and he can't come up with an idea, and that's wonderful. But and honestly, as wonderful as that is, that my intention really was to say there is a fly in the light fixture. And that fly is not period. There are flies in the light fixture now, and for a moment you get a sense that this world is real.
You know, the lead character, John Hamm, I swear, he has this an archetypal 1950s look. I mean, this squared jaw and brill-creamed hair. I mean, did he have the look you wanted, or is that we just like
No, you know, first of all, he's an amazing actor. And part of why he was cast was because I had a philosophy, again, another philosophy, which is that I wanted the audience to believe that these characters were these people. So I was looking for someone who was not well known, but sort of like James Gandolfini in The Sopranos, if you IMDb him or anything, you'll see that the man had been working for a very long time and been making a good living. You just don't know him. And to tell you the truth, he came in a suit and had his hair combed. But he had a vulnerability and an old-fashioned masculinity. This kind of person nowadays is cast as the boyfriend who's too good-looking, the tennis pro. He's kind of a boring, you know, leading man, and there'll be a much more interesting, quirky, funny sort of guy who will play alongside him. But when I heard him read when I heard him read the script, I got immediately a sense of a very old-fashioned masculinity. And we auditioned him, and when we brought him out and put him in the suit and gave him the haircut, you just saw, oh my God, this man has been missing from the screen for a long, long time.
You know, I feel like as we conduct this interview, we should both be smoking Camels or Lucky Strikes because, I mean, the film is suffused with cigarette smokes as life was in the 1950s, and in particular, John Hamm, the lead character, handles it so effectively. It's almost like the cigarette is a character in some of his scenes. Did you have to teach actors how to handle cigarettes like as these folks do? And is there a health issue? There's just so much smoke on the set.
Well, first of all, they smoke herbal cigarettes, and there were a couple of actors who smoked when we began who no longer smoke. And I think herbal cigarettes are unpleasant, but they are not addictive. And OSHA, what used to be OSHA, it's approved in the workplace for them to smoke these things. I do not advocate this in any way. And I actually, from a creative standpoint, do not allow anyone who has never smoked in their life to smoke on the show, because you can tell immediately. It just feels like this sort of awkward prop. And it feels, you know, and of course, actors love to have the business and love to smoke and love to have it in the scene, but for emphasis or whatever. But John Hamm was someone who had been a smoker at some point in his life, and he got exactly what it was. And there is a lot of smoking. I don't find that there's any more smoking than there was in my life growing up. But I do try and write it in. I don't just let people come in and light up cigarettes because it's part of the scene. The prop master doesn't walk around beforehand handing out cigarettes to everybody.
Well, Matt Weiner, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Been a pleasure, Dave.
Matt Weiner, creator and executive producer of the AMC series Mad Men. Mad Men has just earned 16 Emmy nominations for its first season, which is now out on DVD. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Treat me sweet and gentle when you say goodnight. Just squeeze me, but please don't tease me.
That's Joe Stafford from her 1960 album Joe and Jazz. Stafford died Wednesday at the age of 90. She was one of the most popular singers of the 1940s and 50s. Early in her career, she was a member of the Pied Pipers, the vocal group that backed up Sinatra on his early recordings with Tommy Dorsey. After leaving the group, she had hit after hit in the 1940s and 50s, culminating with Columbia Records presenting her the Diamond Award for being the first recording artist to sell 25 million records. One of her best-known recordings was You Belong to Me. She was married to the pianist, arranger, and bandleader Paul Weston, with whom she often collaborated. Among their accomplishments are some of the most inept-sounding recordings ever made, intentionally so. They made hilarious recordings as their alter egos Jonathan and Darlene Edwards. Terry spoke with Stafford and Weston in 1988 after they'd reissued Joe and Jazz and Jonathan and Darlene Edwards' greatest hits. Here's Jonathan and Darlene defiling an Ellington classic.
Been invited on dates, might have gone, but what for? Awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore.
Joe Stafford, when you're singing as Darlene, do you sway back and forth with your eyes closed?
In my mind, I do. In my mind, I do, wearing a hat and white gloves at all times, even in the recording studio.
One of the songs that you do is Alabama Bound, and it features you singing accompanied by a chorus of overzealous, overenthusiastic male singers.
Well, we did that as a sort of a put-on of the Mitch Miller sing-along. And the idea with these singers that backed us up, they were some of the best singers in town. And we just told them to be, you know, they sang very well, but a little, maybe a teensy bit overenthusiastic. And but actually, they did their parts quite nicely, I thought.
I thought this record might be somehow a tribute to Mitch Miller. Now, this is interesting. You'd both worked at Columbia Records, where Mitch Miller was the head of Artisan Repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
How did he take to this little tribute?
We just never asked him.
And we've never heard.
What was the first time that you performed together as Jonathan and Darlene?
I would play piano at parties, you know, after Johnny Green and David Rose and everyone else had finished playing well. I would just play for the fun of it and play like Jonathan. And Joe became Darlene at the end of record sessions when Mitch Miller would send us out some junk to record and the guys in the band, and Joe hated it so much that she would do it as Darlene at the end of the session.
Just as a kind of a way to put down the song that we all hated anyway, just for fun.
So I could see how this tribute to Mitch Miller might have had a real special magic for you under the circumstances.
Boy, you hit it right on the button.
Joe Stafford, let me ask you a few questions about your real self. You had many very popular records during the Second World War. How were you choosing your material then? Did you especially look for records that you thought could really have an extra special meaning to people who were separated during the war?
Well, I think the songs that the songwriters wrote took care of that. You know, there were some great songwriters then, and I think that the times during the war years, I mean, the time sort of dictated the content of the material, and it was there, ready made.
What kind of stories did you hear from people during the war and then after the war about what your songs meant to them, the kind of sentimental meaning the songs took on?
A great deal. As a matter of fact, I still get them. I still get letters saying, I first heard you at so, such and such a time during the war, and someplace in the Pacific or flying over Europe. I still get them. And yes, many of the songs meant a great deal to them and to me. And I was often like the go-between between this fellow and his girl. And what I was singing was, quote, their song, unquote.
When rock and roll started making it onto the charts in the 1950s, did that make things difficult for you both?
Well, at that time, I was doing television, and a lot of television besides the recording. And there was a kind of an attempt to get me connected and to try and do some of that material. And it wouldn't work. I couldn't do it. And but my career continued on in television, which at that point was not that much affected by rock and roll. The music on television stayed pretty much the same for a number of years.
I was doing television then as a conductor. And, of course, we had, in the early days, they would have these rock artists as guests. And I did a show with The Doors with Jim Morrison. And
one.
And I did a show with the Mamas and the Papas, but they were called the Big Three at that time.
You know, Joe Stafford, you had a hit of You Belong to Me, and then the Dupree's had a rock and roll version of that years later. I was wondering what you thought of that when that made it onto the charts.
I don't think... I wasn't even aware of that until some kind of a seminar we had in which some young A&R man...
Snuffy Garrett.
Brought it up as he was using it as some kind of an example of a style that these people could do if they wanted to, and he made a big speech about this song, You Belong to Me, not realizing that I, who was sitting next to him, had been the first one to record it and had a tremendous hit from it. He didn't even know it.
And he said, this song was recorded so many years ago by somebody, you know, was old, you know, and Joe's sitting there next to him.
See the pyramids along the Nile. Watch the sunrise on a tropic isle. Just remember, darling, all the while, you belong to me. See
Joe Stafford and Paul Weston spoke with Terry Gross in 1988. Stafford died Wednesday at the age of 90. Weston, her husband, died in 1996. The late Dutch writer Jan Willem van de Wettering lived a varied and extraordinary life. He was a child during the German occupation of Holland. When he was 19, he moved to South Africa for 6 years, where for a time he was a member of a motorcycle gang. He had an intense interest in existentialism, and he was a detective novelist who not only worked as a cop in Amsterdam, but also spent 2 years studying in a Zen monastery in Japan. So it's no surprise that the bantering between detectives and cops in his crime fiction often has a philosophical edge. Van de Wettering died on July 4th in Maine at the age of 71 due to complications of cancer. In 1997, Terry Gross interviewed Van de Wettering. He told her his interest in Buddhism and existentialism evolved out of his childhood experience during the war.
I grew up in Rotterdam in Holland, from a sort of comfortable family, and everybody knew exactly what they were doing, and we were living well. And then suddenly there was the war. All my schoolmates were Jewish and were killed. I'm not Jewish, so they left me alone, so I had survival guilt. And I began to seriously doubt what I was doing, whether I should continue my life, whether this wasn't a planet that you should get away from. And I mean by suicide, you know, child suicide does happen from time to time. I thought the whole thing was ridiculous. We did a lot of business with Germans, my father did, and there they were bombing us and trying to kill us. Rotterdam was bombed in May 1940. It was the start of the war for the Dutch. And I was right in the middle of that. So I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't accept life. But then life was pretty exciting, too, because wars are exciting. You know, there's all that war material, the uniforms later. There were the British planes came every day, and there were big fights above the lakeside where I lived. And I saw people coming, dropping out of the sky when their planes were downed. I saw starvation. It was a very colorful and very strange experience. So I thought maybe I'd just hold off on the suicide and see if I could make sense of it later. And eventually, after college, I went to England and studied philosophy in London. That was after a stint in South Africa, where I worked for one of my father's companies for 6 years, and saw apartheid starting up, which was another horror. So I went to England, studied philosophy, and I really didn't get the answers, or any answers, except by reading Nietzsche, who also doubts the purpose of life. And I really irritated my teachers there, I think.
Are you saying that you went to the Zen monastery because you were suicidal and nothing in your life, not philosophy classes, nothing else was helping?
No, because my suspicion was that there was no purpose and there was only chaos. And
no purpose to life.
Yeah. And that cheered me up. Because if it isn't there, then you don't have to worry about it.
Right. You don't have to have a purpose or a meaning if there isn't one to be had.
Yeah. And you could still, just to be perverse, do the very best you can.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what Nietzsche, I thought, was propagating. And I really got excited about that. And also about Heidegger and some of the existentialists who were coming from Sartre, for instance. And my teachers were just irritated by that and said, why don't you become a Buddhist instead of prattling about stuff like that? Enter the void, enter chaos, enter meaninglessness, as it is actually preached there in or Taoism or Hinduism. So I thought, yeah, why not? And so I went to, I started reading Buddhism. And Japan seemed like a good place, because someone said if you get sick in Japan, you can go to a hospital, and you get bored, you can go to the cinema. And you can't do that in Tibet or Calcutta so much. You know, Japan is an orderly country. And also, we had been at war with them, and a lot of my relatives were in Japanese camps in the Far East. So that would be another way to get to know a people who were... we had murderous relations with just shortly before. So I did go to Kyoto and stayed 2 years.
Now, did you have to explain all this to your Zen monk? I mean, to your Zen teacher?
No. He was a he was a great guy. That's why I stayed 2 years. Because when I came in, he said through an interpreter, "So what do you want?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to know if there is a purpose to life." And he said, "Well, do you think there is?" And I said, "Well, I rather think there isn't." He said, "Oh, that's great. Then, because at the end of your training, you will find that it was all a big joke anyway." And I said, "Well, the concentration camps are a joke." And he said, "Yeah, maybe. You know, why don't you follow the method and come to some understanding?" And then I said, also I'd been in money-making businesses, and I was bored with money, and he was a great actor. He got up and he said, "Don't tell me you don't have any money." And I said, no, it's okay. I brought some money. And he said, oh, what a relief. Because this monastery is a very expensive place to run. You know, things keep breaking down, they have to be fixed, and I smoke a lot of cigarettes. Cigarettes are getting very expensive. And if you have no money, I can't possibly have you here. I'll have to throw you out. So I said, no, don't worry, I have money. And then he charged me something like $6 a month.
It's so, nothing, I mean, yeah. Right.
And I realized that these guys were wise guys, you know, they were having fun with me, and I liked that. I thought that was very amusing.
So when you left the monastery after 2 years, did you feel any differently about the meaning of life?
No, I thought I had completely wasted my time. I was really depressed when I left. I never understood my koan and
the Zen koan, the riddle that the teacher would give you. Mm-hmm.
And I was terrible at meditation, and my legs always hurt, and I couldn't stand the food. And the only guy I really liked was the teacher, and he was dying. He was suffering from Parkinson's disease, and he would have to retire pretty soon. And I thought I'd completely wasted my time, and I left and went to South America and got a job with a Dutch firm there. And for a while, I looked back thinking, what the hell was I trying to do there? But then it became clear that it had been a very meaningful exercise in meaninglessness. And I still think it's the greatest thing that ever happened to me now.
I want to get back to what happened to you when you were young. How old were you when World War II started?
Nine.
And you were going to a very expensive private school because your father was a financier.
Yeah, everything was just dandy. You know? Mm-hmm, I walked through a park to school every day. But I did get mixed up in a hunger uproar one day. I strayed to the wrong side of town, and this was the 30s. So I was maybe 3-4 years old, and it was the Great Depression, and people were starving, and they were being subdued by Dutch military police with bearskins on horses and they rode their horses right into these poor people and then threatened them with sticks and sabers. So I knew something was amiss even before the war started.
And during the war, during the German occupation of Holland, you said what, that all of the Jewish students in your class were taken to Treblinka, and you were the only student who wasn't Jewish.
Yeah, and two little boys who I always rather liked, they were Germans, but they happened to be in Holland, and they appeared at school in Hitlerjugend uniforms. And they were my schoolmates, you know. What did they know? They were 10, 11 years old at the time.
So all the Jewish students taken together at the same
time? No, it went by address if you lived in a certain part of town. But most of them would have lived in the same area.
So every day there were fewer students?
There were fewer students, yeah. And they were wearing these yellow stars, and it was all ridiculous. But then later, we lived in a big house, a villa on the lakeside, and it was commandeered by the German army, but only half of it. So we had we were living in it, and German officers were living in it. And the officers all happened to come from Dresden in Germany, and that was one day completely destroyed, I think, by the American Air Force or by the British.
The firebombing.
So I saw the distress of these kids, you know. They were young officers in their 20s. And the next thing, they were sent to Russia, and that was a one-way ticket too, because nobody came back from Russia in those days. So the suffering was universal. It wasn't just... you couldn't say, well, if the Germans are bad guys and we are good guys. It was a very mixed picture.
Now, one of the characters in your mystery series is a jazz musician. He plays trumpet. And I understand that that's one of your ambitions, that one of your regrets, actually, that you don't play.
Yeah.
Why don't we end the interview with one of your favorite jazz trumpeters? Would you like to choose somebody?
Oh, Miles Davis.
Miles Davis, okay. Is that how you would have liked to play if you could play?
Well, I don't want to imitate him, but I'm very pleased that at least somebody can play, because if I listen to him, all my questions really fall away. Music is such a direct way, and on his level, it's just beautiful.
Any particular Miles period you'd like to select?
Well, he had a... his own composition, So What?
Of course. The perfect choice for you. We'll play So What.
Yeah.
Jan Willem van de Wettering, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jan Willem van de Wettering speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. Van de Wettering died earlier this month at the age of 71. Writer Hunter S. Thompson died in February 2005, but his death has done nothing to diminish interest in his work. In theaters now, there's a new documentary about him by Alex Gibney called Gonzo, The Life and Work of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson. The actor Johnny Depp reads passages from the writer's work. Critic-at-large John Power says it's particularly interesting to watch the film as we head toward this fall's presidential election.
The late Hunter Thompson came in many different flavors. There was the canny reporter who rode with the Hells Angels, the literary outlaw who battled psychedelic lizards, the political junkie who once said that he looked forward to election day the way sex addicts look forward to orgies. And then, of course, there was the culture hero, complete with aviator glasses and cigarette holder, whose persona would be set in stone by Doonesbury's Uncle Duke and by movies starring Bill Murray and Johnny Depp. They're all on display in Alex Gibney's Gonzo, The Life and Work of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson. Although not a great documentary, there's too much rock music and not enough perspective, the movie provides a useful primer on the last American writer to become a pop icon. And it's doubly worth seeing in this election year, because Thompson's political writing, especially Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 1972, reminds us that campaign coverage was once far more ambitious than it now is. Thompson's coverage of the 72 elections in Rolling Stone was probably the most sustained piece of mind-blowing political reportage ever to appear in our mass media. It was a witch's brew of prophetic Jeremiad, drug-induced craziness, and unrepentant fictionalization. Placing this Gonzo sensibility at the very center of the story, he wouldn't let mere factuality get in the way of the truth. And the strange thing was, millions of people of many different kinds loved his extravagance. Here, Pat Buchanan praises Thompson's work. And then Johnny Depp reads an example of what tickled Buchanan so very much.
There was no one quite like Hunter. It was on the edge and beyond the edge. And it was very funny. I remember he wrote about Hubert Humphrey, the great father of the civil rights movement. They ought to stuff Hubert in a goddamn bottle and send him out with the Japanese current.
There is no way to grasp what a shallow, contemptible, and hopelessly dishonest old hack Hubert Humphrey really is until you've followed him around for a while on the campaign trail. Hubert Humphrey is a treacherous, gutless old ward healer.
He had a view of the ridiculousness of it all.
Thank you. Shalom. Shalom.
And Hunter did some of his best work on the liberals.
Now, Thompson was hardly the only one to write with verve about presidential elections. From Norman Mailer's famous essay about John Kennedy in 1960 to Richard Ben Kramer's whopping book about the 1988 race, this was an era filled with memorable writing about the run for the White House. Still, even by these standards, Thompson was exceptional. His words were like a bracing acid bath. I read his coverage as it came out, and I remember laughing out loud at its sheer outrageousness, like the time he pretended that the dull, churlish Democratic candidate Edmund Muskie was actually using the Amazonian hallucinogen Ibogaine. Thompson was always a superb hater, and he was at his best filleting liberals like Humphrey and Muskie. He hated Nixon, too, of course, writing that Nixon could shake your hand and stab your back at the very same time. But he was actually far less insightful about Nixon than was, say, Gary Wills. And when it came time to championing politicians, he was far from reliable. It's worth remembering that the one candidate who most benefited from Thompson's Gonzo endorsement was none other than Jimmy Carter. By Carter's election in 1976, Thompson's cultural moment had begun to fade. In his prime, the mainstream media had been so suffocatingly monolithic that he came off as a groundbreaking iconoclast, putting in print things that nobody else would dare. I remember gasping when he suggested that Humphrey should be castrated. But nobody today would gasp. For a generation raised on the fervor and coarseness of talk radio and the blogosphere, Thompson's wildest political writings probably seem almost routine. At the same time, the mainstream media learned precisely the wrong lesson from Thompson's career. Rather than grasping that the crucial thing is to be a strong, singular voice, political reporters saw that you can become a star by making yourself the center of the story, usually by playing the visionary pundit. As when Chris Matthews leapt to declare Hillary Clinton finished for losing New Hampshire on the night she actually won it. Where Thompson had no desire to become an insider, which left him free to say what he really thought, today's political media want to appear outspoken and independent, but also have a big network gig. Their patron saint is Tim Russert, who had the powerful mourning at his funeral. It was always Thompson's pride that he never saw a boat that he didn't want to rock. Such pride seems a bit old-fashioned at a time when magazines and TV news are terrified of offending advertisers or jeopardizing their access. We're inundated by campaign news, but none of it seems bold. If you want to feel some real fear and loathing, just ask yourself, would any big publication, including Rolling Stone, be willing to run Hunter Thompson's campaign coverage today?
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. You can download podcasts of the show on our website, freshair.npr.org.